Okay, thank you. So in discussing and reflecting on the role of chaplains in the pandemic, and especially looking back on the very first days, you know, health systems shut down, and there was a sense that only frontline essential workers should stay in the hospital and everyone else should go home. And there was a bit of a question for chaplains. We weren't really sure. No one had told us, are we considered essential workers or not? We consider ourselves to be, but it was never officially formally determined.
We felt that we obviously see ourselves as being essential. But the question is how others see us. You know, we hope they saw it that way. And on the second day after it was sort of declared official that like everyone has to stay home unless they're essential workers, we got our first kind of COVID call. That was for an Orthodox Jewish patient who was dying and the family wasn't allowed in. This was in the ICU. But it was very important to them, obviously, that the patient be treated with, not just with respect, everyone asked to be treated with respect, but there's some very specific customs that they wanted to be observed. You know, we have very specific customs where we leave certain tubes, almost all tubes in the body for burial. We close the mouth when possible. We put straight in the hands and legs and open the hands up. There's a number of customs that we try to observe, and it was important to them, obviously. They couldn't be there, so they wanted the rabbi to go there and observe those customs. And the nurse called us frantically and said, "Rabbi, can you please come up to the ICU and help us with this? Because the family's, you know, asking us to honor this, and we would love to, but we don't know how. It will help us if you're there." So I you know, rushed up to the ICU, and there was a security guard there. And he said, "Sorry, essential workers only. You're not on my list." So I didn't know what to do. I thought, okay, I guess it's being, you know, decided right now by this security guard. And thankfully, right then, the nurse like popped out of the door and said, "Oh, Rabbi, come on, we're waiting for you. Please come in." And the security guard says, "Okay, I guess you are essential. Head on in, Rabbi." And we just decided at that point, okay, we're essential. And then as we started talking to chaplains around the country, you know, what is your hospital doing? And we found that virtually without exception, for the most part, almost every hospital was considering chaplains essential frontline workers. And that was very gratifying because we felt like, you know, we're needed now more than ever. And our role as chaplains is when there is tragedy, when there's disaster, when there's fear, when there's concern, when there's anxiety, that's when we're needed the most. And we felt we're needed now and we should be there. And there were chaplains who, of course, felt nervous about that. And I'll talk about that. And they felt that either they're at high risk or they did not feel comfortable being exposed. And so we also perfected the arts of, you know, telechaplaincy, and many chaplains decided to work virtually through Zoom or by making phone calls. And there's a lot that we can do by phone that we learned that we thought maybe in the past we didn't try. And we found out actually it does work frequently. Someone needs someone to talk to, and having someone, whether it's by phone or not, can be a huge help. And so we did that as well. But for the most part, we found out and that chaplains are indeed essential workers. And that's really important because, you know, in many ways, the role of chaplaincy in some ways was brought back, I feel, in these past 2 years to its rightful place. And why do I say its rightful place? You know that in the Jewish prayer, we know that in the Jewish prayer, the Mishnah Berurah, the healing prayer, the rabbis got it right a long time ago, thousands of years ago. When we say Mishnah Berurah, we pray for refuat ha-nefesh and refuat ha-guf, healing of body and healing of soul. And actually, I said it backwards. It should be healing of soul and healing of body is the way the rabbis, the way the prayer is written. Refuat ha-nefesh, refuat ha-guf, healing of soul and healing of body. And we've recognized for thousands of years that in order for a person to heal, remember, there's a difference between cure and heal, right? Curing is one thing, but there's healing that even when a cure is not possible, a person can still find healing, emotional healing, relational healing, spiritual healing. And for many, many thousands of years, humans recognize, and the rabbis very clearly, the Torah, the Gemara recognizes clearly that part of healing is emotional, spiritual well-being. The thing was, and I'm not going to go into depth in it, this is a whole nother talk, and there's a lot written about this, but as medicine gained more ability to do more interventions, to bring about cures, there became more of a feeling like, well, science is accomplishing so much, we don't need the emotional, spiritual, mental health aspect of healing anymore. We got it covered now. This was what was happening, you know, 100 years ago or so as medicine developed. And unfortunately, there became this bifurcation between body and soul, where hospitals and doctors sort of felt like, you know, we can accomplish so much. Let's do it. Let's provide that cure that we're getting so good at. And unfortunately, there became an erosion of the significance and the centrality of that refuat hanefesh, the spiritual healing that was so central for so many thousands of years. And in many ways, it came back, I think, with this pandemic in so many ways. And I'm not going to get into so much detail because it's just I'm going to cover a lot of different points, but in a few different ways. And so first of all, just, you know, many, many researchers have been noticing this. And by the way, there's some great research, which I quote frequently from some great researchers out of Harvard, Balboni. It's a husband and wife team. And then I can put it in the chat or I can send it to you afterwards. There was a great study that they did where they found, the title of the study was Spiritual Needs Rank High as Death from Cancer Nears. And they found that addressing spiritual needs of patients with advanced cancer, asking them on surveys, was just as important as taking care of their other medical needs. When they ranked it, they found that patients whose spiritual needs were well supported did overall better. And when they asked them what their needs were, they said they want their physical pain to be dealt with and their emotional and spiritual pain. Those were their two highest requests. And this highlighted the centrality of spiritual care for people who are dying with cancer. And there's a lot of research that they were doing on this. But and in particular, you know, we could say, and Rabbi Cohen pointed this out, you know, and we can talk about this more in the question and answer if you want, but what does it mean to be a Jewish hospital, Jewish chaplain? Very often people find that spiritual support from someone who they can relate to. The Gemara, the Talmud talks about, you know, when you visit the sick, you take away 1/60th of their illness. Many people might have heard of that statement. So the rabbis say, well, you know, why not just send in 60 people to visit and then they're cured? So one of the limitations on that, they say it has to be Ben Gilo. Someone, we usually translate that as being the same age. But many of the commentaries say that means Ben Mazalo, someone of the same mazal, but not just zodiac, but someone they can relate to. When someone gets a visit in the hospital, support from someone who they can relate to, someone from their community, someone who they feel a connection to, they're, especially in a place of, you know, of science. Sometimes hospitals can be cold, can be very medical feeling. I mean, obviously, right? It's a hospital. It has to be antiseptic. I get it. But when you have someone who you can relate to, who can speak your language, so to speak, you can begin to transcend the walls of the hospital. And there becomes an especially acute need for someone who you can relate to and can talk about these things beyond the physical. And this became so important when the visitor policies were restricted. And that's why I think that the centrality of chaplains gained significance. I don't know about in England, but in the United States, another thing happened with that was a challenge and is a challenge, but also re-emphasized that importance of chaplaincy, which was that as vaccine mandates spread around the country, and I think maybe around the world, there in the United States, at least, there's only two exemptions to the vaccine. Those were for medical exemptions and religious exemptions. And so what hospitals did around the country to evaluate those religious exemption requests was to put chaplains on the committees to help evaluate the requests. And this was once again, and I'm not going into the vaccine mandates right now, there's just too much to talk about, but it was once again a reminder of, look, when there's conflict, when there is struggle, look how important religion is in people's lives. Once again, when we have to make these committees, and people's jobs were dependent on these committees. So it's a very, very central role for chaplains to be playing. And once again, you know, I always remember, like, I remember one time, you know, I was a rabbi of a synagogue and I was transitioning into being a chaplain. I'm still a rabbi of a synagogue, but my primarily a chaplain in a hospital. I remember one time walking into a patient's room and I introduced myself. Usually I say, I don't know if you can all relate, I would say, like, you know, hi, I'm the chaplain here. And then people, the Jews will respond, oh, you know, chaplain, don't bother with us, buddy. You're not going to convert us. We're Jewish and don't even try it. I'll say, oh, no, by chaplain, I don't know. The yarmulke doesn't give it away. It sits us. But I would say, okay, no, I'm a Jewish chaplain. They say, oh, I didn't know Jews could be chaplains. So I more frequently say, I'm the rabbi here. So then usually the response I get is, oh, you know, you oversee the kitchen or, you know, like, you know, are you here to take my order for lunch? Like, people don't understand still, you know, the role of chaplains and rabbis playing hospitals. But anyways, I remember once introducing myself to a patient's son as a rabbi in the hospital. And he says to me, very gently kind of puts his hand on my shoulder and says, young man, it's very nice of you to come visit, but let me be frank with you. A synagogue is a place for rabbis, and a hospital is a place for doctors. So next time I'm at synagogue, I'll be happy to see you there. But here, I have no need for you. So I just said to him, you know, hey, I'm happy at least that you admit that rabbis belong in synagogues, because I don't think my congregants at least would go that far. So I'm happy with that. That was good enough for me. You know, he laughed. I tried to build some rapport with him. Anyways, he had no interest. He felt like there's no role for a rabbi in a hospital. So I remember a week later, just walking by, he was in the ICU. So in our ICU, many ICUs, the doors are glass doors. You can see right in the room. And as I walked by the room, I didn't want to bother him. He was very clear with me. He doesn't want visits from the rabbi. I don't want to, you know, be too aggressive. But I noticed there was a whole set, like 20 volume set of the Zohar in the room. And I thought, this is the guy that told me that rabbis don't belong in hospitals. So I couldn't resist. So I just went in and said, you know, I was just passing by. I wanted to say hello and wish you well. And he says, you know what, Rabbi, come on in. Could you say a blessing? So I said, sure, I'd be honored to. He said, you know, we got desperate. I said, I won't take it. I don't take it personally. But I said, so do you feel there's a place for rabbis in the hospital? He said, you know what, I was being a little overzealous with my comment there. I want to apologize. Yes, we need support. We're having a hard time here. And I would love for you to visit and spend some time with us. So it's just, you know, a reminder. Sometimes people say there's no atheist in a foxhole. I don't know if that was the point of that story, but it was just a reminder of, like, you know, there is a central place for clergy, for chaplains in hospitals. And I just think that some of these instances during the pandemic are reminders of that. And that's an example of, you know, this, the vaccine committees was just a reminder to me of, like, look, when times are tough, there's so many different examples of when hospitals rely on chaplains. But in particular, it became staff support. One of the most crucial things that chaplains we became involved with was, you know, when we were there, and I'm just going back to those first months in particular, when, you know, chaplains, we kind of realized, okay, we are essential, we're staying here. But our hospital, and many hospitals, I'm just speaking from experience, it was a very big place. We have 16,000 employees, 1,000 beds. On any given day, we can have 20,000, 30,000 people coming through our campus. Of course, when there was the COVID lockdowns, it was like a ghost town. I mean, other than those patients, obviously there were still patients and there were still many thousands of staff members. But in comparison to what we were used to, it was very empty. But the staff who were here were very, very busy. The nurses were overwhelmed. They're getting so many calls from families because the families are anxious. They can't be there. So they're very nervous. So they're calling even more. The staff are putting themselves at risk, right? They're anxious about the exposure to COVID and their families, and they're exposing their families. And it was very new at that time. We still didn't know a lot. And you know, there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of isolation. And so part of what chaplains realize is if we're here, yes, we can go to the patients and we should go to the patients. And I'll talk about that in a second. But the staff, with their anxiety, we started thinking, how can we provide the best support possible? So number one, we realized the staff are getting lots and lots of phone calls. They're being overwhelmed by phone calls. We can step in. No, chaplains cannot become nurses and you know, surgeons. We can't just say, oh, we want to help. We'll do the surgery, right? Now, that's a disaster for lawsuits and death and suffering. But we can answer phone calls and listen to people who are undergoing stress and grief and trauma and anxiety and listen and provide support and help organize at least schedules by which they can call at normal intervals so they can get updates. And we can be there to listen to them well after they get those updates. And we can bring in iPhones and iPads to the rooms and do FaceTime with the patients so that the nurses don't have to worry about constantly being overburdened with that. We can then provide tea, cookies, you know, break, lunch for the nurses and the staff so they can unwind and kind of debrief a little bit. And so it became a very major focus of our work as chaplains. We thought, you know, we can be creative now because, for example, our hospital, every hospital is different. Our hospital is a very open design in that there's hundreds of different ways you can enter the campus. There's no one main entrance. But during these lockdowns and then really throughout, all of a sudden they had to have screening, right, where they screen everyone. So there became just a few, three or four entrances to the entire campus. So we realized, okay, if there's only a few entrances, we can use this as an opportunity and station chaplains at these entrances. and provide little either quotes or gift baskets with, you know, essential oils or, flyers about our break opportunities. You know, we had chaplains providing Reiki or mindfulness meditation or different opportunities for people to take breaks throughout the day, someone to talk to, videos that we created. And so we were able to use these entrance points as ways of staff care. So that became, for us as chaplains, kind of, we always cared about the staff. Of course, that was part of what chaplains do, but it became like a central theme of what we do. But of course, throughout today and throughout prior to COVID and today, of course, one of our main roles is patient care. I mean, but how did it change? It changed significantly. Chaplain's role, the way I see it, primarily, our job is to have very good listening skills, to show compassion, empathy, non-judgmental, non-anxiously, just being there with patients in a way that really helps them feel that they are not alone. And that, you know, that they are with someone. I always think of the study. There was a great study about that looked at people who were about to hike up a mountain, and it asked them to predict how difficult they thought the hike would be. And then they asked people, then they put two people together, walking together, and they asked them the same exact question. The people were not helping each other hike. They were not lifting each other up the mountain, but they consistently predicted that the hike would be easier when they were walking with someone else. This whole idea of, you know, just being with someone else, there is a comfort, a confidence, a strength that comes with companionship, with having someone who's there with you. And that's an essential role of chaplains, obviously. And that became heightened when patients were alone. I mean, they now do not have visitors. And also on top of that, we're wearing masks. So it's much more complicated because good listening skills, you're able to use facial expression to show that you're listening. Because a lot of chaplaincy is being quiet, right? We're being quiet, but we're actively listening. But that becomes much more challenging when our faces are covered. So it requires us as chaplains to be that much more intentional about having good listening skills. And in fact, I'll read you a quote. One of my favorite books is The Choice by Dr. Edith Eger. Actually, she lives here in Southern California, but I heard of her from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks of Blessed Memory. So that's local to you. So anyways, in her book, she has this line that I thought it was just a brilliant line because it's exactly what I always tried to, the way I tried to articulate chaplaincy. She wasn't a chaplain. She was a psychotherapist, but she articulates chaplaincy so well in this line. It's really two lines, but I'll just read it to you. I can put it in the chat too, if you want to copy paste it. She said, "I learned two of my most important phrases in any therapeutic encounter. Here's the two phrases. One, I hear you say blank, blank, blank," meaning reflective listening. "I'm hearing, this is what I'm hearing," so that we show the people that we're listening. "And the three more," and now I'm adding here, "the three most important words in chaplaincy, tell me more." Oh, tell me more. Tell me more about that. Just showing that we're listening. We want to hear more. We care. It makes people feel so good, so validated to know that someone actually is listening to them and cares about what they have to say. So she goes on. "I learned how to read my patient's body language and how to use my own body to communicate my unconditional love and acceptance. For example," she says, "I don't cross my arms or legs. I open myself," sitting in an open format, right? Legs not crossed, arms not crossed. "I make eye contact. I lean forward. I create a bridge between myself and my patients so that they know I am with them 100%. I mirror my patient's states. If they want to sit quietly, I sit quietly too. If they want to rage and scream, I scream with them. I adapt my language to my patient's language as a sign of total acceptance. And I model a way of being, breathing, opening, moving, listening that can promote growth and healing." The idea is that chaplaincy became more difficult, right? When our faces are covered and we have to be more intentional about this. But there are lots of tools that we can use to show people that we are really with them, that we really care. It makes such a big difference. I mean, when I think about my own times, when I go to meet with rabbis or people, you know, if someone's focused on you, facing you, listening to you, I can remember, I'm just giving an example from my own life. I remember in my own chaplaincy that, you know, when I first started, I felt like, wow, I was really connecting with patients. I was coming back frequently. They were calling and asking for follow-up visits, and I was remaining connected. And I felt like, wow, I'm really connecting. And after a few years, I was reflecting one day. I was like, you know, why? I feel like I'm not connecting the same way. And so I spoke with my CP supervisor about it. And she's pointed out to me, she said, you know, you got a lot busier. Are you expressing to your patients that you're busy? I said, no, I'm really trying to be with them. She said, well, you know, pay attention to yourself as you visit patients. And I started looking, started thinking, I started noticing, you know what? I'm not sitting as much. And I started noticing, you know what? I'm sometimes facing the door when I talk to them. Or I'm sometimes looking for cues that they're done talking and say, okay, I'm done. And not exploring more. Oh, tell me more about that. Tell me more. I started forcing myself to be more present. And then I started finding, wow, again, the patients are feeling connected. I'm having deeper encounters. Even though I didn't say something, they can feel it. People can feel it when you're sincere, when you're really, really with them. And this was crucial, you know, being intentional, because, you know, there were many unintended consequences of the no visitor policies, right? Many, many. In addition to the loneliness and isolation of the patients, you know, some of the things we found, for example, just speaking of kind of an ethics perspective, we found that, you know, there is data which shows that when family members are in the ICU with their loved ones and they see everything that's happening, they're usually more likely to understand that everything has been tried and to accept that at some point a time comes when death can be allowed to happen. Not that we hasten death or cause death or remove that. That's a different discussion. But just, you know, there's a recognition at a certain point sometimes comes when everything has been tried and patients die and family feels like, well, we really tried everything. And that can be more emotionally acceptable. Whereas when the family members are not present, they oftentimes are much less willing to accept the death of their loved ones. And so you can imagine how much more they feel this when they're not allowed in the hospital. Not to mention when the visitor policy is only allowed families to visit when death was imminent, that would cause sometimes accidental, you know, unintended pressure on the family to choose to allow their loved one to die, to choose DNR orders, things like that, in order to enable visitation, which is extremely inappropriate and something that we had to really fight against and prevent. But all of these things, you know, were a reminder that, like, if visitation is being so curtailed and people are now, you know, suspicious because they're not seeing what's happening to their loved one, how much more so? We always thought communication skills are important, but now it's even more important to be enabling communication, to be drawing out, to help facilitate communication between the staff, between the patients, between their families, between the doctors. Communication became much, we always believed in it. We always knew it was important, but now it's like we have been reminded communication skills are essential and actively, proactively being good at communicating and giving frequent updates and building trust, how much more important that is. And this leads to another issue, a very, very difficult issue, which I don't know that I have the answer on, but I just want to at least bring it up because it's come up in the past, but these past couple of years have highlighted it, which is, you know, for myself as a chaplain. So a major thing that happened was, you know, we feel horrible. I'm sure that you feel the same way. You feel horrible when people are stuck in the hospital by themselves. They don't want to be here. They want to have their loved ones nearby. And they're sick. People don't know. No one likes being sick. And so we want to help however we can. And most of the staff is too busy, understandably. And as I pointed out, we want to try to fill those gaps. So a very common issue that we had, and I'm sure this was experienced elsewhere, is that patients sometimes need things brought to them. Either they forgot a prayer book at home or a book that they want to read or maybe food that would be better for them, for their own diet, whatever it is. And when the family members can't come in to bring it to them, in normal times, you know, that's not an issue. People can just bring it from home. But when their loved ones and family or friends can't come in the building, so we offered to be the conduit, and we'll meet you outside as the chaplains, and we'll bring it in, as long as we, you know, we have the permission from the nurses and everything. But we'll be happy to bring it up. And we ended up doing this literally every single day, every day. Sometimes the majority of my day was just going back and forth, going back to the street, bringing stuff up, picking things up in people's houses, and we feel that's a big chesed, a big kindness that we can do. And it led to a situation where the chaplains are really patient advocates in many ways. So in addition to our core activity of being good listeners, of helping to bring about that refuat ha-nefesh, the healing of the body, healing of the soul, in particular the healing of the soul, and staff support, we really became patient advocates. And that became with the visitor policy, because there are often times when visitors are allowed, whether it's because of end of life or certain circumstances. So we had to advocate to allow visitors, sometimes to allow more visitors than what had been previously allowed, or to advocate for the patient, for their family, for their rabbinic guidance. And it led to a lot of conflict. Personally, it's been one of my biggest emotional struggles these past few years. I always have seen myself, I'm an employee of the hospital. I work closely with my colleagues. I'm the rabbi of the hospital. I want them to respect me. I want to respect them. I want to have a good relationship. And I always saw that chaplains are kind of like the middle people. You know, we translate medical terminology and medical culture to patients, and we translate religious and cultural values and perspectives to the staff. And we're just in the middle trying to be there for everyone. But I found, and I don't know if others share this, but I definitely found this very strongly, that these past few years, I've been much more of a patient advocate than a hospital advocate. And it's very difficult for me because it's caused a lot of tension with my colleagues in nursing and in leadership of the hospital. I'm constantly pushing for more exceptions, more visitors, more permission, and trying to explain why that's important. And it's not comfortable. It's not comfortable constantly being in a fight with colleagues. And we try to do it in the most kind way and sympathetic way. And oftentimes, obviously, the answer is no. And we have to explain that to the families. And it just brings about a big issue in chaplaincy. And I'm just going to bring up the issue and I'll tell you my opinion on it. But we could have a whole session on just this issue, which is, at the end of the day, as chaplains, who do we report to? Who's our boss? Meaning, we work for the hospital oftentimes. I mean, there's different models, but for my case, I work for the hospital. They pay my salary. On the other hand, my co-religionists, you know, my community members who are the patients, these are people who, you know, my kids are in school with their kids and I see them in shul and I see them in restaurants and I see them around community and we're at each other's weddings and we see, you know, they're my community. And for a reason, you know, we share the same beliefs and we have the same, you know, religious values. So do I report to them? I mean, is my loyalty to them? And at the end of the day, and I actually have this, I'm sitting in my office now, I have this posted on the wall of my office. At the end of the day, you know, we say, da lifnei mi ata ameil. We know who you work for. Who do you work for is ultimately a Kadosh Baruch. We work for God. But that's very difficult. I mean, we work for God, but it's a very difficult tightrope to walk. And to maintain a certain integrity where we are trying to focus on that responsibility to maintain our integrity, who we ultimately report to. Well, you know, if I'm too difficult, if I'm constantly fighting with the staff at the hospital, I'm constantly butting heads with them, constantly going against them, I'm going to accomplish nothing. You know, we have to be strategic about it also. If every single patient that comes in, I'm fighting and making claims and requests about why they need to have more visitors, at a certain point, they don't really care what I have to say because they just know, oh, the rabbi is difficult. The rabbi always fights with us. The rabbi is always asking for more. And so it has to be done with compromise, with calmness, with being gentle and not pushing every single request. It does not have to become a battle. So it's a big challenge, but that's a big issue. And then I'll just bring up in the last few minutes a couple last things. You know, this whole situation has brought about, first of all, for chaplains, the way we've leaned into it, of course, you know, many chaplains ask questions about what about our own safety? I remember at the beginning, towards the beginning of the pandemic, I remember there was a Holocaust survivor who was in his 90s in our hospital with COVID, and his family wasn't allowed in because he had COVID, and he wasn't at the end of life at that point. So, but they were very sad that, you know, he was so isolated and he was a survivor and it was very difficult for him and he didn't fully understand what was happening. They asked me to go as much as possible and bring an iPad to FaceTime with them. And one of the times I was in the room FaceTiming with him, he was complaining that he was very, very thirsty. He was so parched. He couldn't stand it. He was struggling. And the nurses at that point in particular, they would go in the rooms, but obviously they were trying to go in only when essential and they were timing their visits and the nurse wasn't planned to come in for over another hour. And normally as chaplains, we do not feed patients or, you know, or we're not involved with medical care in any way. We have to be very careful about that. But I saw he had a pitcher of water and a cup. He just couldn't reach it. And he was so thirsty. And he's a survivor. It's especially triggering for Holocaust survivors to be thirsty. So I went and asked the nurse, you know, I opened the door. Is it okay if I give him some water? He's so thirsty. She said, yes, absolutely. That would help him. So I poured him a cup of water and he drank. He was so thirsty. He drank it like ravenously. and coughed it out all over me. And I was soaking wet. And I remember thinking to myself, this was at the very beginning of the pandemic. I even got through the gowns we were wearing as my clothes were wet. And I was thinking to myself, okay, I for sure have COVID now at this point. I mean, he just coughed, a COVID patient just coughed all over my body. And I started thinking to myself, okay, now I have to go to other patients. I have to go home to my family. And, you know, like, what do I do now? Is this too much risk for a chaplain to take? And so I consulted with some, you know, with my rabbinic, you know, you mentioned Rav Asher Weiss, and I started thinking about it. And, you know, the basic conclusion that we came to was, you know, that there's a great, I'm not going to go into depth with it now, but there's a great response of the Radvaz. The Radvaz was like the chief rabbi of Egypt in the 15th century. And he was asked an interesting question. The question was, let's say someone was taken captive, a Jew was taken captive, and someone grabs you from the authorities, from the religious authorities there, the political authorities, and says, you know, we are going to kill your fellow Jew. We're going to kill him, that person we captured, unless you allow us to cut off your arm. We can cut off your arm, or we kill that other person. And so what do? Do you give an arm to save a life? So that response is often quoted in regards to organ donation. But it's relevant in many, many areas. So the Radvaz's conclusion there was actually, if there's a chance that you might die as a result, you are not required to give your arm for someone's life because it's too risky, especially thinking about 15th century Egypt. It's not, you know, a modern hospital. The person might die. So he said, you don't have to do it. You shouldn't. In fact, if you might die, you may not do it. But what about if you're not going to die? What about if it's risk, but you'll most likely be okay? Then can you, should you, must you? And he said it would be midat chasidut. It would be midas chasidus. It would be pious to do so. And so what the rabbis I reached out to said to me was, you're not required to do this, but these people are alone. That man, you know, it was probably worth it. I mean, you enabled him. He didn't choke. He didn't die. I mean, he spit up the water all over me, and then he caught his breath, and then he drank the water, and then he was okay, and it really helped him that he was able to drink water. He would have had to wait hours potentially, and it was very difficult, and no one else was willing to go in there, unfortunately, at that time, and give him water. And so my rabbis felt, you know what, there is some risk associated with being a chaplain, yes, but as long as it's not literally likely life-threatening, then it's risk that we might be expected to take. And it's for each person to decide their level of risk tolerance, of course. And some people have, for some people it's higher risk. For some people they have comorbidities and there's reason to be more cautious. So that's for someone to each person to figure out. But it was a reminder to me of like, there is risk involved with chaplaincy, but it's part of the essentialness, going back to what I opened with, that chaplains are essential, that we're essential workers. And so we are willing to engage in some risk. And this leads me, though, to one last comment, one last thing that we learned during this pandemic, or, you know, that not that we learned, but that became especially emphasized. And that was I mentioned staff care and the role that we started playing with helping staff. As we know, around the world, there was a tremendous amount of burnout during this pandemic, a tremendous amount of staff turnover, a lot of suffering. I'm not saying just from COVID, suffering from just everything that was involved with this. And staff were going through a lot. And there is a principle that I realized became especially central and that I emphasize with my colleagues here and around the country, which is that, you know, that there's a requirement in Jewish law to give a tenth of one's income to tzedakah, to charity. Meiser, we call it, you know, a tenth. We give a tenth. But there's another principle called Hamevazvez al Yevazvez Yoser Michomesh. When one gives, they shouldn't give more than a fifth, right? More than 20%. We give a tenth, but there's a limit to how much we should give. Because if we give too much, unless someone's, you know, fantastically wealthy, we might therefore become impoverished ourselves. And then the cycle just perpetuates itself. And yeah, we help someone else, but now we're going to be in need. And so the rabbi said, Al Yevazez Yoser Michomesh, don't give more than a fifth, because there has to be a limit to how much we give. Now, they were talking there about financial means, but the rabbis extended that throughout the generations and said, if you're willing, you'd be willing to give that much for money, of course you'd be willing to give that much for your body And your body just doesn't just mean physically, it means emotionally. And there are many times when a person cannot be asked to do something that giving of themselves is there for more than a fifth. And now it's hard to quantify, right? We can qualify it in some ways, but sometimes you know, okay, I'm reaching my limits here. But how do you quantify that? But there are times. And so here's what I started saying throughout the pandemic to my colleagues here. You know, let's say, for example, someone works 50 hours a week. So yes, I know there's times when we have a very busy week, very busy times, we work more. But let's say on average, someone works more than 50 hours a week. So I said to them, you must make a limit. The limit must be 60. Let's say you're working 50 hours a week. So it has to be more than a fifth would be 10 more. So you cannot work more than 60 hours a week. You must have a spot where you say, we need to control. It has to be a limit. It's a marathon, right? Life's a marathon, not a sprint. You're not going to make it working in the hospital, working if you don't have those limits. Let's say someone takes 14 days off a year for vacation. I guess you call it holiday, right? Someone takes 14 days off a year for holiday. So they cannot take less than 11. Don't go down less than 11. Don't reduce it more than a fifth, because you have to have time for yourself. You have to take days off. So there is a way that we can even quantify that one fifth rule. And I became kind of very fanatical about pushing people. You know, we're really giving of ourselves a lot now, but you can only give so much of yourself if you want to be able to continue to give of yourself. Otherwise, you completely wear out. And so that one fifth rule, I found, is a very, very good way to, at least it's a good way to articulate the essential nature of having limits, of having self-care. And it became especially emphasized during the pandemic. So there's a lot more to say, but we said we'd go for 45 minutes and then have discussion and questions. So that was 45 minutes. I'm happy to just keep talking, but I'd love to see if you have any initial questions, reactions, comments.
Anyone to ask a question? I just want to talk about can I ask a question which is unrelated to the pandemic?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? What happens when you have a situation? Clearly, you're an Orthodox rabbi, as I am. But what happens in a situation whereby you have a range of patients in the hospital, of course, and you have a situation where, for example, the patient says, well, I'd like to have cremation. Or a similar situation would be where it might go against your own personal beliefs. In a case where the patient says they'd like to have an abortion, let's say. Abortion's not always so black and white, let's say, but in this situation. How do you sort of deal with that? How do you handle that?
It's a great question, very common question for chaplains. I'll answer you in the way that the way the question first came up for me. The big question that came up for me in that regard is when I first started working as a chaplain 15 years ago, was a very common call that we received for a patient. The phrase we use is for terminal extubation, right? A patient is ventilator dependent, they're on a vent, on a respirator, and the family has decided that since they have no chance of recovery, to extubate, what they sometimes call pulling the plug, and allowing or causing usually fairly immediate death as a result. So I very, very frequently, meaning almost daily, get referrals that the family, this is the decision that's been made, and the family is requesting the rabbi to be present for that. And my question when I started here was, well, am I allowed to be there for that? Can I do this job even? And one of the first rabbis I asked, just as kind of talking about it, because I don't believe in shopping.
Rabbi Wana, could you just repeat the question for the benefit of those on the Zoom? I don't know if they heard it. The others. We did hear in the room, but perhaps I think the others on the chat, somebody said, if you would repeat the question, that would be easier.
Sure, that the question was dealing with patients who make decisions that go against my own religious values and commitments. And the two examples you gave were abortion and cremation, which I'll come back to. So when I had this question about the terminal extubation, and I started, you know, I don't believe in shopping around, asking a bunch of rabbis to get the answer you like. That's not appropriate either. You have to have, you know, one or two, you know, your rabbi who you ask. At least that's how I feel. But I was talking with some, you know, Torah scholars and rabbis who I respect. And a couple who I asked about it said, you know, you can't be there. You can't do the job. But you know, there's a story of Rav Chaim Brisker, that someone in his synagogue was captured by the authorities, and they said they were going to kill him his last wish was for his rabbi to come visit before he dies. And they came to him in the synagogue and said, come visit this person because it's his dying wish. We're going to kill him as soon as you come. So the rabbi said, okay, I'll be there soon. And he didn't show up. Every day he wouldn't go because he said, they're only going to kill him when I go. Unfortunately, they ended up killing him anyways. But so the many people told me, you can't go because you're aiding and abetting. You're supporting this. It's misayeh. It's lifnei iver. It's the Torah prohibition against putting a stumbling block before the blind or helping in sin. But I decided, you know, I have to ask the rabbi who I ask all my questions to. And I'm not going to even say, because there's a couple, I'm not going to say right now because I don't know that he wants me to say it publicly, even though I'll just say without it. But he said, not only can you should. And at first I was shocked. I said, I should. He said, look, you should go there and be there with them and be compassionate and sympathetic and support them. And you obviously cannot be there and tell them that what you think they're doing is permissible by Jewish law. But he said, first of all, do they, when you show up, do they see you, and this is an important distinction, do they see you as the posek or the chaplain? Posek means a decisor of Jewish law, or a chaplain means, you know, emotional, we call it, what do they call it, pastoral care. So I said, really, really for pastoral care, but sometimes they might ask, they might say, well, is this allowed by Jewish law? So I said, first of all, if you're there to provide support, sometimes when they ask, you obviously can't tell them the wrong thing. You can't go against Jewish law, but you sometimes can guide them, meaning to answer your cremation question. Oftentimes they'll say to me, Rabbi, we've chosen cremation. They won't usually say, what do you think about that? Sometimes, more often they'll just say, I know you're probably against it, but I'm just letting you know. They're just mentioning it as a side point. So they're not asking my permission. So often my response will be, because I'm a chaplain, I have to be careful. I can't just say to them, I can't just condemn them, right? But I will often say to them, oh, tell me about why you chose that. And very frequently the answer is, oh, it's cheaper. So we have a program here. I'm sure many communities have this program. We say, oh, you know that we have a program where we will pay for traditional Jewish burial for free. It actually give you free burial if you'll choose that instead of cremation. And many, many times they'll say, oh, okay, I didn't know about that. Yes, sign me up. So, you know, but let's say they say, no, I'm not interested. So still the role is, I can't say, okay, then I approve of it. But we can still be compassionate and be there with them and provide emotional support. So this rabbi who I asked, who said you should go anyways, I give you two examples. So he said, he once had a congregant in his synagogue. This is now a Hasidic community. He said he had a congregant who was suffering his whole life. He was unable to be out of his wheelchair his whole life. He was on a trach, and he really had a difficult life, and it had gotten worse at a certain point. And he asked someone to ask the rabbi to come visit him in his home. And this rabbi came to visit him, and he says, Rabbi, I can't take it anymore. You know how much I've suffered in my life. And I just can't take it anymore. I'm going to remove the trach, at which point I'll die. And I want your permission because I can't do it without your permission. So the rabbi said, I can't give you permission for that. I feel horrible. I do affirm how much you're suffering, but I cannot give you permission for that. So the congregant said, okay, I knew you weren't going to say it's okay. Will you at least just pray for my soul after I die? Because I'm going to do it anyways. So this rabbi realized he had a significant dilemma now, because if he says, yes, I'll pray for your soul, he's kind of condoning the action. But if he says, no, I will not pray for your soul, I mean, how could you say that to somebody? He's sick and he's suffering. You're going to say to him, I won't even pray for your soul after you die? Like, it's so callous. So he said he had to make a decision in a split second. So he said, yes, I hope you don't do it, but I will pray for your soul. In other words, he was clear that he's not condoning the action. But he says, you know, at the end of the day, I will have compassion for you. I understand, and I will pray for you. And he told me that incident was 4 years ago, and this individual has not done it. He said what he needed was someone to listen to him, someone to show compassion. And when, you know, I don't know the status in England, but in California, physician aid in dying is allowed. So it's not euthanasia completely. The patient has to self-ingest, but it is, people are allowed to what they call physician-assisted suicide. So when it became illegal 5 years, when it became legal 5 years ago in California that doctors could prescribe a medication and patients could take their life, we were very nervous because what is it, will this mean for an observant or anyone who has a conscientious objection to that action, right? It says, I don't agree with that. So we brought out Rav Asher Weiss from Yerushalayim to speak to us, to speak to our doctors, to speak to the Jewish doctors about what should they do if one of their patients is terminal and makes this request. So what we thought the answer was going to be was, you know, you're allowed to declare conscientious objection and say, I'm not comfortable taking part of this. I excuse myself from this case, and I'm not going to have anything to do with this patient. He said to us, I think you, Davka, should be involved with these patients. You should be involved. Everyone thought, what do you mean? What do you mean? Isn't this not forbidden by Jewish law for someone to intentionally take their life? So how could you say to us that we should be there? So he said, you should not condone the action. You should not tell them what they're doing is a mitzvah. But they are going to want to have someone to talk to about it. And if you say you're not willing to talk about it, you're going to relegate only those people who are advocates for it to talk about it. Only those people who think it's a good thing. And then the patient's going to have no one to really bounce these ideas off of and really have a conversation, because the people that are going to talk to are the people who think it's a good thing. So if you can do it in a respectful and compassionate way, then they can at least have the conversation. And fascinatingly, after he said this, a study came out of Oregon, which was the first state in the United States to allow this. So they've been studying it the longest for over 20 years now. A study came out of Oregon, which was they asked people, they have to fill out a survey in order to get access to the aid in dying pills. And they found that, over 50% of the people that got the drugs to end their lives did not do it. So they started comparing the surveys and trying to see, what are there any factors in why people are not doing it? And interestingly, and this was just fascinating, I'm happy to send out the study if you'd like to see, they found that one of the questions they ask is, are you religious? And they found that of the people who were religious and opted to take these medications, but then in the end did not take the drug, another question was, has your clergy been supportive of you or judgmental about your decision? And those whose clergy were supportive of them, not supporting their decision, just supportive of them as human beings, were then less likely to actually ingest the medication. They were more likely to feel, I feel supported. I had an opportunity to share my fears and concerns. I now have the sense of control over my destiny. And I felt compassion and love from my rabbi or clergy. In Oregon, it was most likely not rabbis. And they were less likely to actually do it. Rav Asher Weiss told us, you can't tell them it's allowed, but you can be there to listen to them and hear about their concerns and help them talk about other alternatives and talk through it. And of course, you cannot make the prescription. It comes down to that. You can't, but you can at least be there to have the conversation. Someone then asked him, so just to go a little bit more closer to your case, Rabbi Koden, someone in that setting then, and this has been published since then, said to him, well, I'm an anesthesiologist. Can I provide anesthesiology for an abortion? He said, yes. He said, why not? They're going to do the abortion anyway. So it's not lifnei iver. I mean, lifnei iver, to be prohibited under do not put a stumbling block, it has to be two sides of the river, right? That they couldn't get to the other side of the river without you. So he said, your role as the anesthesiologist is to provide comfort and support and pain relief. So to provide that relief for someone who would be doing the action anyways, it's not prohibited to provide that relief. And so too could be said for chaplains in many ways. Obviously, we cannot tell people that what they're doing is allowed, but we can provide comfort, we can provide emotional support, and recognize that actually oftentimes by providing that support, people end up actually making a different decision because they feel respected and accepted by you, and then they might not actually make that choice that you were concerned about.
Thank you, Rebel. Fascinating. I'd like to ask you something else. A patient passed away. The relative, the family decided they want to do cremation. What do you do then? Did you hear the question?
No, I couldn't hear.
If the patient passes away, or when the patient passes away, and the family, excuse me, the family want to do cremation, then what role do you have in it? What will be the role of the chaplain there, where the patient passed away? Well, I guess you've got a legal issue. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, when the patient passes away and the family chooses cremation, the role of the chaplain. So this is unfortunately a very common issue. And there's a few approaches. Number one, we have had cases. I'm willing to admit this. I hope it's okay. But we've had cases where a patient either said or they found out from their will after they died that they chose cremation, and the family was shocked to find out. And the entire family was unified in their opposition to that decision. We have felt that we can go against the patient's wishes sometimes if the entire family, there's a unity in being opposed to it, and we can make the argument, meaning we hadn't had a clear discussion with the patient, but we can make the argument that if they would know how much emotional distress their family was put under because of this decision, that they might not have made that decision. And so sometimes we've had cases where we only found out after they died that they put that in some kind of a will or advance directive. And then the family is horrified and shocked and upset. And we say, you know what, we can go against this decision because maybe they didn't make it in clear mind and sound mind. We didn't have a chance to discuss it with them, and the family's upset about it, so let's go against it. The more challenging issue is when either the family is not united, meaning some of the family members feel like we have to honor their wishes, or the patient was very, very clear. And they made that, you know, in front of their durable power of attorney or whoever, they were very clear, this was my decision. This is much more complicated. And as a chaplain, again, I can never say I'm an Orthodox Jew, I'm an Orthodox rabbi. I can never say that what the Torah forbids is allowed, right? I will never say, oh, cremation's allowed, you can do it. I can't say that, no. But sometimes our hands are tied in certain ways. And we have to say, what's the way to make the best of this situation, of a horrible situation? How can we at least make the best? So for example, there's so much family feud, unfortunately, at end of life. Families are torn apart. Can we find a way to try to enable family unity? You know, I remember a time that I was asked to give a blessing to a patient before surgery. And I remember I come in to give the blessing in the pre-op area, and the daughter sitting with the patient. And right when I walk in the room, the daughter says, who are you? What are you doing here? I said, oh, I'm the chaplain here. I'm the rabbi. I was asked to come see the patient. She said, no, we didn't ask for you. We didn't ask for a rabbi. We don't need a rabbi. So I said, okay, whoa, no problem. I'm sorry. It must be the wrong room. I'm saying, get me out of there. So I don't need to impose it on someone who's, as I'm walking out, a man starts walking in with a big yarmulke and beard and sits us, and he says, oh, Baruch Hashem, the rabbi came. Come on in, rabbi, I called for you. And he walks me in, and I see his sister really rolling her eyes and saying, oh, he called you, figures. And I think, oh boy, family dynamics, here we go. And I said, you know what, I was just leaving. I don't need to impose anything on you. And he says, okay, no problem. If she doesn't want you to give her a blessing before surgery, you don't have to. I said, fine. So I'm walking out of the room. And the daughter then says, wait, rabbi, come on back. Now's a good time for you to settle a family feud. Remember, there's the patient here, alert, awake, about to go into surgery, a serious surgery, the daughter and the son, all there in pre-op. And the daughter says, could you please tell my brother that my mother, when she dies and is cremated, as is her wishes, that she will not burn in hell as my brother tells her she's going to. So this is not as easy. I remember at that point I was basically dripping with sweat by then. And I just said, you know, I think we could talk about this another time. I don't think you're going to burn in hell. I mean, that much I could say. I could try to thread the needle a little bit. You know, we don't support cremation, but also I don't know that it's proper to say you're going to burn in hell. I wouldn't use that terminology. And I think we could talk about this another time. But right now, you know, let's say that prayer for the surgery, and, you know, and I try to use some positive words. Anyways, it turned out she did okay, thank God. But I remember a year later, when she died, the brother was talking to me a lot about this decision. And the patient and the daughter, who was the power of attorney, the daughter, were adamant, this is what they're going to do. And there was a lot of family tension. And I said to the brother, you know, And I asked, again, I don't want to say the names just because I didn't ask the permission, but I asked a world-class rabbinic authority, let's just put it that way, who you'd all recognize their name. I said, I asked his opinion, you know, is this guidance right? And this is what he told me to say, in fact. He said, tell the brother, you know, don't make the chilul Hashem. Don't fight it. Tell him, you made it clear. I am against this. I believe it's against Jewish law. You know my opinion now. And on top of that, I cannot help with the process. When she dies, I cannot call them and make the arrangements. In fact, I can't be there when it happens. But if we have a memorial separately, you know, things like that, we can do that. In fact, we said this rabbi guided us, you could say Kaddish, because her decision was not based on a rejection of resurrection of the dead and Jewish belief. The rabbi said, you know, he said, I want to maintain our family unity. In fact, we could do a tahara before, so she can still have that, you know, purification of her body. It might be contradicted somewhat by cremation, but still, we can try to do things and then bury the ashes as a compromise. At least the ashes should be buried. That's at least better than not burying them, you know, Jewishly. So we can, at least you can be clear in your opposition, but do it in a way that you maintain the family unity. And you say to them, this is your decision. You can make it. I'm not going to fight you anymore. I just have my limits on what I can support. And the focus as a chaplain becomes on how do we maintain at least cohesiveness of the family and do things at least in the least bad way. There's actually a story. I'll conclude with this. It's London. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a story about London. He was asked, there was apparently a discotheque. I don't know if that's what you call it there. A bar, a club in London that they wanted to use, rent out for Yom Kippur davening, Yom Kippur services. And someone asked Rav Moshe Feinstein if it was right. They had said that some of the rabbis had said it's wrong. How can you have Yom Kippur davening in a bar? Obviously, they're renting it out. But it was. It turns out that it was a type of a bar or a club that was a kosher. It was like a kosher establishment. So they asked him. They asked him if they had to reject the people from using, that's a different case. The case was of a wedding. They wanted to do a wedding that's right. That's what it was. The London case. I'm sorry. It's a different case. The London case was they wanted to do a wedding, which would be not appropriate to his standards, but in their catering hall. It was a kosher catering hall that would normally not allow, you know, whatever it was, mixed dancing and things like that, that they normally weren't comfortable with in his community. And Rav Moshe Feinstein said, if the alternative is that they're going to then go to another hall, which is not going to be kosher, not have kosher food. So what advantage, in what way are you helping? In fact, you're making it worse. Let them come to your hall and at least they'll have kosher food there. So sometimes when we can't do things in the ideal way, we say, well, at least what's the least bad? What's the least bad way we can do it? And so we try to find some kind of sort of compromise in that way. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, let's see if any questions on the chat. I don't think there is actually. Would anyone like to ask anything else? Can I get in again? Oh, one second, what's this?
Do you ever experience resentment from colleagues that you are doing so much and asking for so much for a Jewish patient? Why should they get more or better treatment?
Yeah, that's an excellent and very uncomfortable and difficult question. That's why we're extremely careful to couch things always in that it's not, people don't deserve anything just because they're Jewish. That's not why we advocate for them. We advocate always on behalf of people's, you know, cultural sensitivity, their own rights, their own values. And so when we're advocating for someone to have something, you know, let's say because it's Shabbos, so we want to have a special dispensation. We always make it clear that, you know, if it was any religious tradition, it's not just because they're Jewish. I always go out of my way to make it clear that it's not people. We're not advocating just because someone's Jewish; they don't deserve something special for that reason. What everyone does deserve, though, is cultural sensitivity, cultural competency, and if we couch it in that way, you know, we should accommodate everyone's cultural, you know, specific needs. It happens to be that Jewish law has some very specific requirements and restrictions that sometimes make hospital stays very challenging. And so we need very specific dispensations, you know, whether it's related to traveling on Shabbat and things like that is a very common example. But we try to make it clear that it's not only for Jews.
I'd like to ask you something further, Rabbi Weiner. What would you do? You're the head of your chaplaincy team at the hospital. We have a chaplaincy team over a range of hospitals here. Some are more experienced. Some are less experienced. Some are more experienced at certain specialisms. And some have less experience at certain specialisms, clearly. What happens if somebody feels that they're not very experienced and they've been asked, let's say, to visit, for example, a mental health patient? They don't have any particular skills, any particular expertise. could they maybe go and do more damage than good, or should they go and support the patient? How would that, what would you kind of say to that?
Right, it's an excellent question, because chaplains get thrown into all kinds of things. And you reminded me, by the way, just a side point before I go to your question, is that, another thing that this pandemic has kind of reminded us all of is the importance of having professional chaplains in hospitals. As we recognize the centrality and the importance of having people doing this work, it's helped us to advocate to hospitals. A lot of the stuff we can't rely on volunteers. We need to have professional chaplains hired by hospitals to do this crucial work. Now, of course, there's going to be areas where chaplains don't have an expertise. And so I'm a big advocate of consulting with people. This is the best way of learning. We call it in Hebrew sometimes shimush. If we can consult, our institutions do have experts who can guide us. And if we can advocate on behalf of our importance, meaning the way I always describe the importance of chaplaincy is, imagine a pharmacist walks into a patient's room and says, "Hi, I'm the pharmacist. Just wanted to check in and see how things are going today." The patient's answers you're usually going to have to do with their medications, right? Because that's how they see the pharmacist. When a chaplain goes in the room and says, "I came to wish you well. I came to check in," it opens up a different part of the person, right? It opens up a more spiritual, emotional realm. So there is this real value in having someone visit from that perspective. So I will often turn to mental health professionals or medical professionals when it's a specific issue, and say, I think it's important to have a chaplain involved in this case, but I need some guidance in terms of how I can be most helpful and in what way would be detrimental, and to have that humility when with patients that, we can only do so much. Sometimes we simply say, I'm not sure. I need to check with someone and get back to you, because we have to have humility about the extent of how much support we can provide and in what ways we can be most helpful. So I oftentimes check in with professionals before I visit a patient, and then again after to debrief, and then before the follow up visit.
Thank you. Obviously, someone's going to be themselves and explain things, the situation as they see it, and obviously know not to go and put on a certain point and to consult as necessary. Rabbi Smucho, did you want to ask something? We've got Rabbi Smucho, the chaplain actually of one of our hospitals which have the biggest number of Jewish patients, certainly practicing Jewish patients, I would say. I don't know if you can see him.
Yeah, sure. Hi. I was just wondering, do you have the outside Jewish community, various gemachim and volunteer organizations trying to get into the hospital with best intentions in the world, but a lack of coordination between the different gemachim? Or how do you deal with that to coordinate and make sure they're compliant?
And if I may say, sometimes tension in the hospital.
Sure, yes, there's tension in the hospital. I'm just wondering what it's experiencing in the hospital.
Yeah, it's a big issue. We often have, organizations that really have good intentions and want to help, sometimes push themselves in a way that can be detrimental, and we can do more good when we work together. One of the things that I've found, it's not a complete answer because I don't know that there is a complete answer, but one of the things I found is that outside organizations who want to help, and they're great, and thank God that, we have so many organizations of Jews who work so hard to make a difference and help people and really want to help, and it's really a beautiful thing. Most often inside the hospital, the place where they excel is when there are gaps. When there's a gap, someone needs to fill the gap. And so what I've tried to do is work very hard to prevent gaps, and sometimes it causes, I talked about having limits before. Sometimes it makes it hard to have those limits. But as much as we can prevent those gaps, and we can be clear with these organizations that, sometimes it's very good. Sometimes there doesn't need to be. The gap is good. We have an organization, for example, that provides meals for Shabbat for people who need meals for the family. So I can't provide all those meals. I'd love for them to come in. Obviously, it has to go through me because I need to be able to tell them, sometimes there's dietary restrictions and things like that. But I don't want to replace them. We need them. But sometimes it's done in a way that's either aggressive or redundant or not beneficial. And so I'm very clear with them that And it's important to have those relationships with the leadership of the hospital so that you can be clear with them about who, you know, should be have access and when. And when they make mistakes, I mean, we had a case where someone back in the beginning of COVID where someone was granted permission. We advocated, we got some permission to visit. And then someone else from one of these organizations sent like all these angry letters to the board members and things like that to try to give them permission. They didn't realize we'd already gotten the permission. They upset people so much that they revoked the permission. So I had to call them and say, and in a very stern way, and say, you know, sometimes when you think you're helping, you're causing significant damage. And in the future, please, let's find a new way to do this. And I explained to them what the damage was. And I made it clear also to our leadership, when these people contact you, just send them to me, because we need to coordinate this. And so there is a need to sometimes create those boundaries. It's a big challenge. But you know what? It's also, when you think back about it, it's also like a Mik Amcha Yisrael moment. Also, like, it's so beautiful. So much people want to do so much good, so much helping. And that's really a beautiful thing.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It's the exact same Mik Amcha Yisrael.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Is it okay if we could get your contact detail? Or?
Sure, of course. Yeah, I'm more than happy to be in touch anytime.
Rabbi, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Perhaps also you'll send me after some of the studies or some of the things that you referred to, and I can send them around.
Sure.
Thank you. I think that's been an uplifting, exhilarating, informative, I can't think of any more adjectives for today. I would ask you for a pre-lunch coffee and Danish, but I know just how busy you are, Rabbi Weiner, that you won't be able to join us for that. But I must thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here for us. It's this evening for you, I think just now around about lunchtime. So thank you very much, and we look forward to have the opportunity to having you again, or to being in contact with you in different ways again, and strengthening the America-England connection for us. So thank you very much for your presentation.
My pleasure and honor. Keep up your holy work and your amazing work.